So today on Tuesday 10-Minute Catch-Up, we're doing something a little bit different. And this one doesn't have a time limit on it because I'm talking to Lucy Brown. Now, Lucy is a public health collaboration ambassador, but she also is a consultant and a coach. And in fact, I won't try and describe exactly what she does because she can do that for herself. So hi, Lucy. Welcome to UK Low Carb.
Hi. Thanks very much for inviting me.
No, it's great to have you here. And you've brought something quite unique to my show. So that's why this isn't really just a catch-up. This is a bit more than that. And you sent me a test called the GC Index, which I don't know much about. I took this earlier today, and now you've sent me a PDF, and it's got all these lovely colours and you know, what do you call it, like a graph and charts and stuff. But I thought it'd be an interesting show to find out about what this is, how it works, and then what you can tell me. And by the way, listeners, I don't have a clue what this reveals about me. So I'm learning at the same time that you're listening to this. So can you just go through that with me? What does it show me? And I think you've got some extra questions as well. So yeah, let's go for it.
Okay. All right. Well, before I tell you what the report says, and as you say, you know, I've kept it a bit of a secret. So you haven't really had a chance to look at this before, before our chat. But before I reveal that, can you just give me a little bit more of information really about you? So I'm really interested to know sort of what you know, what makes you tick, and in terms of your background and where you've come from, you know, how you've got to where you are in your career as well. So just take me on a quick tour of your childhood and how you've got to be where you are now and what it is that you do apart from interviewing people like me on these podcasts.
Okay. I mean, I don't know how much detail you want because there's quite a few years of stuff there. But so childhood, firstly, depends what you all know, really. So it's a very happy childhood. I've got two sisters, very supportive parents to the extent that they even now help me with my business and do jobs for me, like making the boxes and come each week to help with bits and bobs. My mum comes and looks after my children on a Friday. Well, not during lockdown, but she will soon again. Yeah, very happy, carefree childhood, really. Not much from there. What other sort of details do you need? Sorry. So not that I'm nervous that I'm now on like my show being asked about my...
Totally right. So
you're the interrogator. I'm the interrogator.
What sort of things did you enjoy doing at school? What were you like at school?
Yeah, so at school, this is quite personal, obviously. Of course, it is about me. But I really struggled at school. And I was never good at spelling or writing or English. I was never good at maths. I really found school just a massive pain in the backside, really, which is ironic because I became a teacher later. But I didn't realize until I was at university that I had dyslexia. And for me, school was a place where I just failed at everything all the time. Okay. So, you know,
I'm not laughing at you, but you'll know why I'm smiling later.
I imagine that you could probably relate to this, or maybe you've had other people who can relate to this. But basically, school for me was just like sitting in a classroom, being bored, not being able to succeed. Because, okay, this is going to my philosophy of schools a little bit here. But I think in quite often a lot of education is the teacher has the right answer. You don't know what it is. You're trying to get the right answer. So there's an infinite number of wrong answers to get. And so in some ways, I probably thought it's just best not to really bother, not to try. And I remember this one time in primary school, they said, if you want to stay back after the lesson and like do a spelling test, then you could get a house point or something. And I was like, I was rubbish at spelling, but I was like, no, I'm going to do it this time. I'm going to stay back. So I stayed back and did the test and didn't get anything right. And then they said, well, have a house point because you've put the effort in. And I was like, no, I want to get it right, you know. And I really got frustrated with school. I don't think in a way that I think sixth form was a lot easier for me because I then could focus on three subjects I actually like doing, like classics, philosophy and ethics, and also what's the other one, can't remember now. Now I'm talking to you, it's a long time ago. And then I think it was kind of in terms of just to finish the education story, it wasn't really till university that I think my brain kind of clicked together and it then made sense. And that's when I got diagnosed with dyslexia, got a computer. And then suddenly I had the equipment to make my life easier. And actually at university, I think I was encouraged to be more of a free thinker and not in this rigid, this is the curriculum, this is what you follow, this is what you do. In terms of like physical stuff, I was never really a physical kind of kid either. So the only kind of PE lesson I remember, which was amazing, was when I was by chance in the right part of the cricket field when a ball came and I put my hands up thinking, oh my God, good luck everyone. And it landed in my hands, and that's complete fluke. But of course I was like, yeah, what do you want to know? That's just, I'm a fielder as it looks like now. So yeah, so I was never really, school was just a drag for me. It really was. I didn't enjoy it at all. And when I was a teacher, I was uber aware of that for other kids thinking, you know what, this is a place which can be really painful and hard to go to. The difference is, of course, kids nowadays don't get away from it because they've also got like the social media element of their school as well, you know, their school friends.
So what did you teach when you became a teacher?
So my subject's history, but I also taught government and politics A-level as well. I taught mostly, well, year 7 to year 13, which is like, 11-year-olds to 18-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And now, apart from baking cakes, what happened when you stopped being a teacher? You've also been, you're also a broadcaster and...
Well, so I've done several things really. So there's no such thing as like a simple career for me. So when I left university, I was doing like some work in a call center to make money, but went out to India and I was teaching there in the south of India, came back to the call center and more money to go back out there again. And then I did like a tour of Asia. So I got to work with the UN in Cambodia briefly. And that was like working on projects where they were doing landmine clearance. And then I was working with the doctors who were treating people who were affected by that or by diseases. And my job was basically to entertain the children. And I learned a little bit of Khmer, the local language, and Chumrip Sua Soksamai. There you go. It's my showing off my language skills. That's about all I know now, by the way. That's Mandarin, isn't it? You just said.
I know, but it's.
Yeah, strange. Okay. So I was out there doing that. And then when I came back, I actually was trained to be a priest in the Jesuit order. So I was then, I was before that, when the Pope John Paul II died, I'd always been raised Catholic and very pious. And I thought, I'm quite an intensely religious person, especially when I was younger. And I just thought, maybe this is the right career for me. I don't know. So I went to join the Jesuits because I met them in Cambodia and just loved their lifestyle. And when I was doing that, I got sent to Palestine to work in a refugee camp, worked in a homeless shelter in London. But after like 18 months or so, I realized I wanted to have a family and children. And one of my superiors said, in the order, said, I think you make a great teacher. So they sent me to a school placement and I hated the idea of it. But then I thought, actually, there was something in there I quite liked. And so when I came back to Norwich to my parents' home church and everything, my ex-head teacher said, oh, I'd like to come into the school and see what we've done. I don't know why. And turns out I was having a job interview and I then became a pastoral support worker, did my teacher training later. Didn't really enjoy teaching. There's a bit of a trend here, isn't there? I've chopped and changed and done lots of experiences. But I do think, this has always been my problem in a way, if things aren't exciting, then I kind of think, okay, can I see myself doing this career until I'm 60, 65, maybe 70 years old? And I'm going to be in the same classroom in the school that I was actually taught in myself, for instance. That wasn't, a good look when I'm 70 years old. He's never left. Even I changed some schools, I just realized it wasn't right for me. I hated the admin. It's boring, the marking. The teaching itself, there's a lot outside the classroom, which is the awful bit of teaching. Me coming in dressed as the Pope Urban II to launch a crusade for year 8, or, turning up as a plague doctor for year 9, or, setting up the Jack the Ripper murders and bringing in a real lamb's kidney to try and get the kids thinking about murders. That's my kind of teaching. That's the thing that I love doing.
Experience.
And that's why, I was like featured in a Hodder education publication about teaching and learning when I was teaching history teachers in a national conference. And I was bringing all these ideas, but I thought, the career quite often is the boring side, the admin, So in the end, I tried to pull away from teaching, worked for a social enterprise, where I was working with schools, getting them to go out to Kenya and Borneo and South America to work on social projects. And in that time, I've been very active in the Labour Party. I stood for Parliament 3 times and for the council a few times as well. And then I decided I want to learn how business works. So I set up a business and now that's employing me completely because it's like, quite successful. So there's a few, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it answers my question perfectly, actually. And I think we're going to see how that plays out in how, and it was interesting, the questionnaire that you answer for the GC Index is not one of those laborious ones. It's very quick. And it's quite fascinating sometimes. And I was working with someone else last week and he said, I can't believe that from those few questions that you asked, you got me spot on. You know, it's incredible.
Really?
How
I don't know that how, for me yet. I'm a bit nervous. Okay.
So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Right. Just pause there. And I've now given my screen over to Lucy. She's going to show some things up. Now, I appreciate for a podcast, this isn't going to help. So we'll describe exactly what she's showing me. However, I'm going to put this onto the YouTube channel as well. So if you do want to go and look at this information, then you're more than welcome to. Right, Lucy, over to you.
Okay. So what is the GC index? So I talked to you about this and explained to you that what I do in my consulting practice is I look at things from a central perspective of the gut-brain connection. Okay, so I can approach things either from the side of people's nutritional health and how they're treating their bodies in terms of how they're eating and how they can improve aspects of their physical health by improving their nutrition. So,
okay,
you know, the focus on sort of low carb, healthy fat, which is where we sort of connected, but broader than that, looking at the gut microbiome. Because if you are not eating correctly, then you're likely to be having problems and your gut and your brain are connected and you'll be having difficulty with, you'll be experiencing stress, you might be depressed. You know, there are all sorts of knock-on effects that are not just physical, but also mental. On the other side, if you are very stressed and you are suffering from anxiety and depression, that will be having an effect on your hormones, on your adrenaline, your thyroid, your adrenal glands, etc. And that will be having an effect on your digestive system. So we all know how we feel when we suddenly feel stressed or under threat, how that can impact our digestive system. And basically what happens there is that, you know, we were programmed for our bodies to react to danger. So everybody talks about the tiger being chased by the tiger or the lion. And what happens when we are in a stressful situation is that our bodies go into a sort of lockdown situation and it stops the gut from working properly.
Is this part of fight or flight, really?
The fight or flight. Yeah. So all of the energy is going to our muscles so that we can run away from the problem.
Okay.
And then what's supposed to happen is as soon as the problem's gone, it's passed, the tiger's gone away, imagine you're a zebra or a zebra, if you're American, yeah, and you're running away from a predator and you've outrun it and the predator's gone away. 5 minutes later, the zebra's there happily eating the grass on the savannah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what we're designed to do. We're designed for that massive shot of adrenaline, of cortisol, and then it all goes very quickly down again. The problem with most people's lives today is that's not what's happening. So we're living in a time where we're under constant threat and constantly anxious. And so that's having an ongoing effect on our stomachs, on our gut, and our gut is no longer able to function properly. So if you take the perfect storm of both of those, so, you know, what's happening on your mind and what's happening in you're not feeding yourself properly, it's a perfect storm that's going to cause all of these metabolic syndromes. So I work with people from one angle or the other, either people coming to me and saying, I'm really unhappy. You know, all this pandemic thing has made me really understand that I'm not in the right job. I mean, you take your description.
A lot of that, isn't there? I've heard a lot of people saying it's trying to change.
Yeah, you take your description of your career, you know, outside before COVID, you know, just finding your way through and sometimes getting stuck in things. You know, a lot of people get stuck and I'll be able to show you why you don't get stuck in a minute. But a lot of people get stuck in roles that are not right for them. They're not happy. They're not happy in their career. They're not happy in their team. They're not happy happy with their boss. And that's causing them this constant stress. Yeah. So, or they'll come to me and they'll be saying, you know, either I'm trying to lose weight and I'm stuck and I'll explain, you know, why that's happening. Or they'll have some underlying health condition. That's something, you know, a word that's been used hugely as part of this pandemic, you know, all the focus on whether people who have underlying health conditions, metabolic syndrome type things, you know, whether they're more at risk from COVID. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, it can be somebody who's just had a health check at work and being told that, you know, they're obese you know, because they're in the obese BMI category, that their blood sugar's high, that their blood pressure's high, etc., and they're told to do something about it. And, you know, most of the time people will say, oh, yeah, and they go back and they go to the gym a bit more and they, you know, cut out the booze in the week or something, and then they just trickle back to their normal behaviour. But this is, and they don't feel ill. They don't think they're ill today, but this is just setting them up for bad things in the future. Anyway, back to the GC index. Okay. GC index basically plays to the head bit. So this is helping. I use the GC index. It can be used in lots of other ways, and I will also use it in other ways more broadly with teams and organizations. But from using it with individuals, this is basically what it does. So it profiles your proclivities. So this means it's the ways in which you feel most engaged and energized when it comes to making an impact on your world.
Okay, so I've done things like Myers-Briggs, and I just want to say, is this very different to that? I mean, the questions didn't seem to be as similar to what I've done in the past Myers-Briggs.
The difference with the GC index to things like Insights, Myers-Briggs, PI, those things, they're much more focused on behaviours and personality.
Okay, right.
Okay, so you might be a very more introvert person or extrovert person, but that doesn't explain where, when you're doing things, whether or not it's what you really enjoy doing, it's where you get energy. So if you,
okay.
One of the ways that I describe it is, imagine it's Sunday night or first thing Monday morning in the normal world, not in this weird world we're in now, but in a normal world where people go to work. Yeah, and you're thinking about the week ahead. Are you thinking, oh yeah, I've got to get a good night's sleep because I've got that project tomorrow and I can't wait to get started. And, you know, I know it sounds a bit silly, but really, do you feel that what you're going to get up to and what you're going to work is somewhere where you're going to add value and it's going to energize you? Mm-hmm. Or are you thinking, oh, how many hours is it till Friday? You know?
Yeah.
I've done both of those.
I'm definitely in the first camp now, but I have been in the other camp, definitely.
Exactly. You know, how long till Friday? And you might not even know that. You might not even recognize that. All you know is that you're not enjoying what you're doing. And you know that your energy is very low. And you know that you're not adding value. And I actually, in the last job that I did, the last discussion I had with my boss was, when I was planning to have the conversation with her and she beat me to it, one of the things she said to me was, I've talked to the rest of the team and they can't see where you're adding value. And I said, nor can I. I'm not adding value. I'm not doing what I thought I was coming to do. The things that I'm doing don't engage or energize me. I mean, I didn't have this vocabulary then because I haven't done this. This is a few months later that I discovered the GC index. I said, I'm not adding value. So no, I agree. It's no fight, you know.
Yeah.
How can we stop this? So basically your profile will help you think about how you can play to your strengths and how you can maximize the contribution that you make to a role, to a team or an organization.
Right. I'm getting nervous here because this is about my profile now and I really want to know what you've got.
You put yourself up for it.
Yeah, I did, but I just can't wait any longer. You know, I'm going to burst in a minute.
If you look at the bottom here, basically the GC index was created by Nathan Ott and Dr. John Mervyn Smith. And basically they built it around organizations that were saying to them, and the way they were helping, Dr. John is a psychologist and he was helping clients identify executives for lead roles in organizations.
Okay.
And a lot of them were saying, we really need game changers. And what was happening is
that what GC stands for, by the way? Game changer.
Yes,
right, okay.
Game changer. So they were saying, we want game changers. We're driving change. We're driving transformation. We really need game changers. And then they'd go out and get these people and they'd last 6 months because they just wouldn't fit into that sort of an environment. What they thought they needed from a game changer was not what they were, wasn't what they needed. So the research that the guys did was to go out and really identify what were the proclivities of a game changer in the context of an organization, you know, being brought in to an organization, et cetera, and able to make a difference and survive.
Okay.
And out of that, they then obviously identified a lot of other proclivities that they didn't think were the game changer, that was something else. And that's basically how they built the whole matrix.
Okay.
Okay, so let's just to explain it more. So the matrix itself has these dimensions. So on the right-hand side, you will see the dimension of obsession.
I'll just explain, okay. Sorry, to the listeners. So Lucy just showed me a circle. It's in four quarters with a purple circle in the middle of the bigger circle. And then there's like a box around it. And on the right-hand side outside of the circle, it says obsession. On the other side, it says pragmatism.
Correct. And at the top, it says imagination. And at the bottom of the quadrant, it says action.
Okay.
So the roles at the top of the at the top of the circle, they're more ideas focused. And the roles at the bottom of the circle are more task focused.
Okay.
Now, this, again, just as with, you know, things like insights, you're not just one of these things. So when you are profiled, you will have a score for each of these proclivities. So the top right, so we do it in typical Boston matrix sort of style, the top right, we've got the game changer.
Okay.
And the game changer is therefore the two sides of the axis, them are obsession and imagination. So they're the highest things that are driving them. So in this case, imagination is the capacity for original thought.
Okay.
And obsession is the drive to turn ideas into reality.
Right. So you'd like tie in those two if you're the game changer, right?
If you're the game changer, you've got this high capacity for original thought.
Okay.
And you have a drive to turn the ideas into reality. So that would be the game changer. Move around the circle to the strategist. So the strategist
is on the left of that, right?
Top,
on the
top left. Yeah. And they're really focused more, they're more pragmatic. They still have the imagination aspect, so the capacity for original thought, but they're more pragmatic, okay? They're going to be putting that more into a structure, into a context. They're the strategists. Okay. Keep going around the circle. The next bottom left is the implementer. And the implementer is pragmatic and action-oriented.
Okay, so if I could say it another way, it's almost like the doer. They implement, they
do. Exactly. I call them the doers.
So they might get told the vision from somebody else and they would make it happen.
Yeah, they would make it happen. So probably, and the next slide actually explains that a bit more. Or page shows that a bit more. Then round to the last quadrant is basically the polisher. So the polisher is back to the obsession side. So the drive to turn ideas into reality, but they're more action oriented than the game changer. So the game changer would be the ideas. I call them the bouncy tiggers.
Okay.
And I get told off because they might not be bouncy, but you know what I mean. They're the people that come up with the original ideas. Whereas the polisher will be the person that will also be just as obsessive about it. But is more action oriented. So if your highest score was for game changer, you know, you really are out there on a limb and you are really going to need people with strengths in all of these other areas in order to make stuff happen.
Now, are we kind of a mixture of all of these? Is that the idea?
We're a mixture of all of these things. So you get a score of 1 to 10 for each of these proclivities.
Okay.
In the middle, tying it all together is the playmaker. Okay, and the playmaker really has the drive to create collaborative endeavor and collective contribution. So they're the people that are really focused on making sure that all of this works. So the playmaker isn't somebody that's there. It's got nothing directly to do with how well you engage other people or how well you get other people to come and play.
Yeah.
It's about, and I had a very interesting one again last week where it fitted perfectly because it had a strong playmaker proclivity and he has a strong strategist. And basically he was able to go and work with any team, even if he had no interest in the topic that they were working on, and he would be able to play that strong sort of facilitator playmaker role because it was all about delivering on the objective, not delivering on his objective.
Yes.
It wasn't about getting people to come and do stuff because he thought it was important. It was being able to create collaboration and create consensus with all of the people, regardless of what the objective was. Yeah. So that's
okay.
So that's because a lot of people think, you know, I would think that you would expect to have quite a high playmaker because you're out there talking to a lot of people, bringing people to the table, you know, engaging with a lot of people.
But I'm saying nothing because if I say yes, I think I am, I might not be. I don't want to set myself up here. I have no idea.
What I'm saying is that's why it's important to understand it. It's not about the energy so much to do with personal energy to do with it. It's to do with the energy to make sure that the whole thing works together. Yeah, bringing everything together to deliver against the objective, the outcome. Being very outcome oriented. Okay, this just takes the same model again for those that can't see it. So the game changer, if you put this into a business sort of flow context, the game changer creates the original ideas.
Okay.
The strategist makes sense of the ideas. The implementer, the doer, makes them happen. The polisher creates a future to be proud of, makes them brilliant. And the playmaker makes it all work together.
Okay. So in a team, you'd want those kind of roles really just to complement each other a little bit.
You'd want people with those different strengths.
Yeah.
In order to make it all work. And depending what you're doing, you know, you would have different, you need different balances of teams depending on what it is you're trying to achieve.
Well, you know what? I'm already getting a feeling for how I operate a little bit. And I don't know what the result is. I've not looked at it. I've just seen these first few charts.
Go on then. That's a good thing to do next. Where do you think I'd be
a little bit weaker. I think the implementer is definitely going to be low for me because I'm somebody who comes up with a lot of ideas. So I'm definitely stronger on the game changer. I'm probably more right sided because I think I'm much more about ideas. And I mean, I have loads of ideas and I'm chucking them out all over the place. And actually my wife says, right, write them down and tick them off one at a time. And I'm like, yeah, but there's more ideas coming in, you know? So I have a tendency to be more ideas creating and not necessarily completing them. Although I do complete a lot of ideas. I'm making a podcast now, for instance. So, you know, it's not like it's impossible, but I have probably, you know, 99% ideas and 1% action probably sometimes, which is not so good.
Okay, we'll see.
That can be wrong. And then I think strategy as well is something that I'm a bit in the moment. So I don't think that ties into that, but I don't really necessarily plan the future. I can see what's going on now and come up with new ideas for the future, but I can't necessarily see a way to structure it. And then the playmaker, I don't know on that one. I think I'm most confused on that because, well, we'll see in a little while when the result is, but I'm not entirely sure if I'm high or low on that at all. I don't know. I'd like to be high on it, but I guess that's the dream, isn't it? It sounds like to me, because it's the most, you know, uniting, bringing people together kind of role, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it's the orchestra, you know, it's the conductor of the orchestra. Okay, so just quickly at the top, it says everyone can make an impact. So this isn't saying that any of these roles is more important or higher value than any of the others, yeah? And down here, I love this. There's a little phrase here at the bottom of this page, and it says, not everyone is a game changer, but everyone can make a game-changing impact.
Okay.
Okay, so yes, we call this top right-hand, you know, the game changer or the change maker. We have a slightly different version of it with another group of people I work with where we call this the change maker. But you need, there's no point just having this here. You just have this here, the game changer, and you didn't have these other elements, then nothing would happen. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not going to drive change. You're not going to drive transformation. You're not going to improve stuff unless you've got all of these proclivities basically in an organizational perspective. Okay, and this next two pages, we haven't got time to go through now, but what they basically do is they look, most people will have two key proclivities. Their two strongest will have two with the highest score out of the five. And basically the research and the analysis comes up with some examples of leaders and what sort of leaders they would be given that. So at this point, we talked about impact, and what we're measuring here is impact. An impact is made up of your proclivities, so these elements, plus your skill set. So it's not so much like MBTI or the others where they say, you know, you are what you are and you'll always be that. unless you have some major life-changing experience, you know, you will always be an ENTP or whatever it is that you are.
Yeah.
This is more pragmatic and more practical. So it's much more dependent also on your experience and the skill sets that you've developed, because you may have found yourself in a role that doesn't necessarily completely fit mm-hmm. you, but you've had to do it. So you've built the skill set. Yeah. So yeah. you might have a slightly higher score on something that you don't particularly feel that comfortable with, because you can, you know. So somebody asked me, I was doing another webinar a couple of weeks ago, and somebody said, so if we were in a team and we identified that we needed a strategist and we didn't have one, and I'm an implementer, but I can be, you know, I can do that, could I sort of step up and say, well, actually, I can play that role? And the answer is, well, yes, absolutely. If you've got skills to do it, you can play the role. But don't necessarily do it for too long, because you won't be getting energy from it.
Right.
And gradually you will be ground down by doing things that aren't what you really enjoy doing.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's the important thing is, we can, most of us do different things and we can be successful at them, but it's not necessarily where we get our energy from or where we really like to play and where we feel we really add value.
Funny to say that, because I actually have a bit of a theory on this, and that's when people say that somebody's lazy, I don't honestly think that anybody's genuinely lazy. And I don't honestly believe that people, that some people just are never lazy at all. I think it's more the fact that laziness is doing something you don't like. And, you know, if you said to me, can you go please and, I don't know, clean the car right now, I would be as lazy as anything on that. Whereas if it's working out a problem in the business, I'll work till 2 a.m. happily enjoying myself. So, you know, I think we've all done that, haven't we? We're in the wrong place at a certain time in our lives, and we're doing a task or, you know, a job, a career, whatever, which just does not match us. And so you feel like, I can't get motivated. I'm being really lazy today. I can't get into it. Well, no, it's just not the right job for you. That's why I look at it.
Exactly. And that's why, and at the moment with all that's going on as well, and people having to work in this different environment and different way than they have done before, you know, a lot of people working remotely, working in teams, people being onboarded into new jobs remotely. You know, if you aren't doing something that actually matches your proclivities, and you're also not in an environment where people can see you and where you're engaging with them directly all the time, you know, that is a recipe for real disaster.
I can imagine there must be a lot of mental health problems of that too.
And just from a business perspective, in terms of productivity.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a productivity, you know, exhaust pipe, because it's just awful. So understanding where the people in your organization, in your team, fit into this kind of a paradigm could be really powerful in helping, you know, move forwards and get to this new normal.
What am I then?
Now we're going to go to what you are now. So, okay, let's do the big.
I'm not a leader at all. There you go.
Wow.
So the screen that's just come up is my profile scores. And okay, just to sort of show you. So on the right-hand side, we've got the chart that we're looking at already, the big circle with those different bits on. And then on the left-hand side, we've got different circles of varying size with numbers on, which I imagine would be my score on those areas. And it's a bit lopsided, right?
It's very lopsided. So basically, you have come out with a 9 game changer and a 9
out of 10.
Polisher out of 10.
So I'm obsessed, apparently.
I'm very obsessed. I think you know that. So basically, in terms of the numbers, if you score a 1 to 3 in something, it means that you have little energy or inclination for this role.
Okay.
So you may tend to avoid roles of this sort when you can. So as a consequence, you may not have developed the requisite skills to perform well in these roles, but you still might be able to do them.
I've got a couple of threes. So I'm a 3 on...
So you've got a 3 on implementer, which you predicted.
Yep, I thought that, yeah.
And a 3 on playmaker.
So I'm not a team player. I'm a bit of a out there maverick, maybe. Would you describe it like that?
I think you're more maverick, yeah. I think you're more maverick, definitely. So... I mean, we're not going to be able to go fully through this, so you'll be able to read it yourself. And maybe you can come back to me again with some questions afterwards, but once you had a chance to read it fully. But yeah, you'll understand that when you read all of the output that you're provided with. So a 4 to 6 suggests that you may have some energy or inclination for the role, but not predominantly so. So if and when you take on these roles, success is likely to be more dependent upon discipline than the inherent satisfaction that you may derive. So this is the bit we were talking about earlier. So it might be that you've had to learn the skills, that you've developed the skills because, you know, that was something that you just needed to do as part of the role that you were taking.
Okay.
And then 7 to 10. So you have a 4 for strategy. And you said you're sort of in the moment. If it's, you know, if it's something that's important to you at a particular point in time, then you will put the energy into it in order to make it. I mean, sure, you've had to have more strategic thoughts about your business and where it goes and, you know, how you develop it to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think that's something I've had to learn, really, because, I mean, otherwise, where would we be going? But I tend to, you know, how some people can be really locked into a debate in themselves about what's the right thing. I think I can sometimes be quite a gut-centered person to be like, process the information, weigh out the pros and cons quickly, make a decision quickly and move. I don't, you know, which can be quite beneficial in some ways, but also quite damaging in other ways. It's not good or bad. It can be a bit of a mixture of both.
Yeah. I mean, there's no good or bad in this. There's nothing that's good or bad. This is just a reality check.
Yeah.
It's not good or bad. If somebody that's got a 9 here is not better than you because they've got a 9 and you've got a 4.
I want a 9 and everything.
You wouldn't want a 9 and everything.
Okay. And what about my 9s? Because I've got some big 9s.
I had another one last week and he had all even numbers here and a 7 in the middle. And he was a consultant focused on transformation and change. And that was it was very clear what he did. He basically says yes to everything. And, you know, and then he goes off and works out who to work with to make it happen. And it was absolutely perfect, this depiction of how he is. So if you are 7 to 10, it suggests that your natural energy and inclination is to take on this role. So your ability to be effective within the role will depend on your experience and the degree to which you have the opportunities to develop role-related skills. So I've had a young person, for instance, who I was very interested to see what she would be because I knew there was a lot of potential there and it wasn't coming out. And she was a 10 game changer. But she hadn't had any opportunity really to rock her 10 yet. Yeah. She hadn't really been in the right place in order to express that. And that was really fascinating. Right. So what happens next with the profile is it gives you goes into quite a lot of detail of what that actually means. So the first page says, okay, how do you have the greatest impact on your organization, your life, your environment, whatever. So your highest scores are the roles of game changer and polisher. Game changers are very open to new ideas and have the imagination to see what is possible in ways that others don't. And so your profile will suggest that you have a strong need for creative expression. How does that?
Yeah, completely. So with my business, some people say, oh, you have a brownie business. And the way I look at it is, no, I've got a media business, which is part of a low-carb community, developing products which people can try, but at the same time, communicating with them, making videos, podcasts, whatever. And it's way bigger than just I bake brownies. And I find that a bit frustrating because it's like, no, we could really make this explode and build on the community and help people connect and get meetups one day. And, you know, and so if somebody said to me, which I won't obviously share completely on a public forum like this, what's your plan for 10 years? I've got about 7 or 8 massive ideas, which would be quite different to what we are now, but this could be what we are now could be part of that.
Yeah. By the way, I'm a polisher game changer. So I'm an 8 polisher and a 6 game changer.
Oh, right. Okay.
When I first decided this is what I was going to do rather than working in IT anymore, I got really excited about organizing a big event because I'd lived in the Netherlands for 2 years, then Singapore for 2 years. Out of my 5 years of being low carb, I came back and I was like, it's really taking off. There's loads of people that are interested in it now. You know, let's have a conference. Let's have an event.
Yeah, brilliant.
And let's started polling people and I was asking Asim Malhotra and Tom Watson and Zoe Thompson, etc. I was saying, you know, it's time. And then I was introduced to the PHC. I think that was when somebody, one of those people said, well, you know, but we've got this conference coming up in March, public health collaboration, probably a good idea to go for that first and then see what the appetite is and then do it. But I was on it. I mean, I was that was it. I was already having this big event in sort of October, November this year. Now, luckily, I didn't get very far because,
of course,
it wouldn't be happening, would it?
Yeah.
Next
year, I'm up for that. Let's do it.
Big ideas, you know, I want to make us, I want everybody to be as passionate and understand what it is that we've discovered. So game changers, you're not constrained by the tried and tested, and you often challenge and question received wisdom and traditional ways of doing things. And I think this particularly plays out in your description of school.
Okay.
Because, you know, just having to do the follow the stuff by rote and do things because you were told that that's what you had to do is not something that you would have been comfortable with at all at school.
My mum describes that as maybe she said, like, I could see your brain because I'm very lateral the way I think about things, and I'm definitely not. My wife laughs about this all the time. She'll say something will be discussed, and I'll completely understand it in a different way to what she understood. And she said it's almost like your brain has always tried to interpret the, like, lessons and interpret conversations and interpret things, and it's worked really hard to find ways around my dyslexia. And that my brain's always ticking for that reason. So, you know, my reading was very much based on almost a photographic memory to try and, like, associate words with sounds and in a way that other kids didn't. And I've had to, you know, the tried and tested just doesn't work for me. I've got to try and adapt things for my own understanding, which I think also helps me have different ways of thinking about things, which is probably quite a benefit, actually.
It's a huge benefit, and it's something that we're finding. I'm saying we, but I mean, Dr. John and the team is one of the things they're looking into, because what happens with this profile is it's going into a big database, basically. So we're creating a sort of AI environment where we can slice and dice the data by, you know, by role, by industry, etc., to understand whether people are more one way or another way inclined in different environments as well. And one of the things that they've been discovering, and I've already found it with what I've been doing, is that the people that are very high game changers are very often dyslexic.
Really?
Or somewhere on the spectrum.
Wow. So, that's interesting.
And it's something that Dr. John is going to be following up on, and he's going to be looking to talk to people to really deep dive into this. Now, one of my sons is he's a game changer polisher, so stronger game changer. He's a 10 game changer, I think, and then a 8 polisher. Mm-hmm. Nightmare. You keep having all of these ideas bouncing out your head all the time, but you're never happy with them because you want to polish them and make them perfect all the time. So he will, he's an adult. He can, you know, he's a brilliant chef. He'll make something. He'll say, oh, how is it? Or, you know, that's fantastic. And he'll never be happy with it because it's never as perfect.
Yeah, it's never as good as it could be. And I can relate to that to some extent.
A really frustrating place to be. He isn't dyslexic, actually, but he was labelled as ADHD when he was at school. So he hated school. And he is bright as a button, really, really clever. But, you know, school was a complete anathema to him.
Yeah.
This is being borne out time and time again, particularly that top right-hand area, the game changer. We will often find that people will then say, yeah, I'm dyslexic, or, you know, it's really...
But you amazing. Know what I find really quite sad is that, okay, so my teaching, so just go a bit more into my background. So I was teaching in classrooms for 2010 to 2016 or so, and that's when I left teaching full-time. But I then did different placements in schools as a supply teacher, long-term supply, and I kind of realized that most classrooms seem to be the Industrial Revolution kind of model, where a batch of children come in at a certain age altogether. They then go through the system, you know, one classroom at a time throughout the whole school as they go through from, like, you know, reception to eventually leaving at the age of 18. And they're taught certain things, certain skills each year as they go through. And it's really impersonal. It's a very much a factory model where the child goes in one end and then the young adult comes out the other. and everyone is kind of generated in the same mold, which I know teachers are brilliant. And I know that as a teacher myself, that's a very kind of crass way of putting it, but that's the system. The teachers themselves, of course, do add a lot of value individually to people. And of course they do. But when I was working in a special needs school for a term, I felt that there was actually much more of an acceptance to actually provide a curriculum which is much more individualized, because there are fewer children to the teacher. They're generally put in a classroom based on their need or their skills, their abilities. So you actually have children who are much more kind of given the need that they have at the time. Whereas at 30 children in a state school, you're not going to necessarily get that. And I just felt like, yeah, there was something more there. The special needs sector schools are much more able to teach, I think, the state sector something about how to personalize education. Because otherwise, you have almost like, well, this system, the state sector is probably good for 60 to 70% of everybody, so that'll be fine. And then 30%, like, I don't know, I'm making up numbers, but whoever the ones who don't fit in, we feel like we just get dropped, like it doesn't matter. And that's why I became a teacher in a way, because I really thought I could help those kids.
Fix it. Yeah.
I wanted to fix it a little bit, yeah. And now I realize I can't do that necessarily because the teaching's not right for me. So instead, if I became the Minister for Education, I'd definitely, make that my thing. Not saying that I'd get elected, but, I'd really want to focus on education, because I think there's so much we could do here.
So I can tell you something exciting. There is a young person's version of this. It's called the Young Persons Index.
Oh, great.
I'm accredited to do that as well. So it's aimed at kids aged 12 to 17, 18.
Right.
And the idea is exactly that. It's to give them something to understand where their strengths, proclivities are outside of academia. Because very often in your experience and the experience of my son and many other kids' experience, what you're expected to come out with at the end of that period, that sausage machine, is not anything that reflects you and what you're good at. And so we basically do this, and it's accredited now as part of the careers framework. So it's used in schools, and there's all sorts of projects and programs that are run around it. So that's really exciting. I haven't been able to do anything with that yet because schools have all been shut. So
that's
one of my other jobs once everything gets back to normal. Same as the PhD ambassador stuff is,
it's fascinating.
These are all things,
it really is.
All things that we've in our toolkit. But it is really fascinating. And I did one of these with a guy who's 17 and has been labelled with Asperger's.
Okay.
And it was really fascinating. And again, I know this kid's got huge potential, but he's, really struggling in the school system. And he basically came out with a very interesting profile, so quite high scores in all areas, but his highest scores were at the top. So he was a strategist game changer. And imagine school is all about the bottom. It's all about implementer and,
doing your work well.
With the action and that side. And he, he just wants to ask why all the time, and he wants to have a debate, and he wants to understand and discuss, and that's seen as, not what you do at school. That's seen as disruptive and whatever. So
sad. What a missed opportunity that is.
I basically said to him, look, you've just got to get through this next 15 months until you do your A-levels. You've got to try and get your best, rock that bottom of the chart, because you've got good skills there. Just do it. I know you're going to be bored and whatever. Just do it to get the best scores you can, because then you can get to university and then you'll find you. You said when you went to university was the first time that you felt that you really then.
Yeah, I remember. Energy. So I remember there's an essay in particular, and it's about Giddens Agency for Change, kind of an essay, because my degree is in archaeology. So there's a lot of anthropology in it as well. And so this essay, I remember writing it, I got a first in this essay, and I was like, I've never done well in academia before. So how the heck did I get a first in an essay? The percentages were a first, but I remember writing it, and it was just like, the whole essay idea was, how did Giddens, and of course I knew of him as a influencer in the Labour Party in the 90s. So I kind of knew about him as a philosopher, and I thought, this is a really interesting topic. How is it people affect change in the world? And how is that, for instance, the meaning of a church, for instance, how does that change over time, or the meaning of a stone circle to the, people of the Neolithic, how would that be different to, like the Bronze Age and those kinds of things? And how is it, we tried to understand this interpretation. And then I completely turned the whole essay on its head and talked about the influence of my essay on the reader and how that's actually an agency for change in the way that they understand this whole topic. And I really just thought, I'm going to play with this. Like, sod it. I'm fed up of being told I don't think in the right way. So I'm going to completely turn this essay on its head and even to make this essay an example as much as a stone circle from the Neolithic or the Paleolithic. I'm going to literally try to completely change the concept. And she said, I've never seen that. My lecturer said, I've never seen that done before. That's perfect thinking, because it was completely original. And I was like, wow, I can actually be original and get marks for that. Because even as an examiner for government politics papers, I used to get really frustrated where you've got the mark scheme and you think, well, I've got to implement this mark scheme on what they've written. But actually, surely we've got to be allowed, and exam boards are pretty good at this to some extent. If somebody's got a real kind of fiery brain and they're making connections left, right, and center, then they should get marks for that. But it's tricky. And sometimes examiners are like, well, I don't really want to stray too far because the mark scheme says one thing and maybe they're going off the topic. And I actually honestly think interesting spherical thinking is about tying together lots of different information to try to make an argument and really turn ideas in their heads. That's kind of my approach.
Exactly. But you do that when you're 13 or 14 in school. They don't
You get an F. Yeah.
They don't like it. So that's the problem. So
we probably just don't do it. You don't engage at that age because you think, what's the point?
You either become a troublemaker because you're bored and you're not, you know, you can't, there's no point, or you keep being told off for asking, you know, too many questions. It's, you know, you're seen as a troublemaker, but it's just your brain is firing off all the time. So yeah, it's a very interesting. I think the young people's one is really powerful. And we could talk for hours about that. But anyway, let's get back to you. So you're not, because we talked about that one, the clarity with which game changers see possibilities, often coupled with a frustration with the ways things actually are, drives them to initiate change.
Definitely agree with that.
This drive is often obsessive, fueled by a need to turn an idea into reality. This is also reflected in your polisher profile. So polishers will often see value in perfecting products, processes, and procedures with a focus upon continuous improvement. This is also consistent with your implementer profile, which suggests that at times you will struggle to settle for good enough.
Okay. Yeah, I can relate to that.
So, I mean, you know, I had a 4 here and my job was completely implementing my last 3 roles, really.
You had a 4 in the implementing sector. Yeah. Just because some people can't see this. So you were saying you had the bottom left-hand corner, which is implementation.
I'm
3 and you're 4.
You're 3, I was 4. And so
we can't be bothered with that implementing.
I can't be bothered. And at one point I was having to focus on this massive spreadsheet for months and months. And I just became totally obsessed with it. So the obsession, you know, because I'm a polisher, I just got obsessed with that spreadsheet. And I'd drive people mad because the spreadsheet became the most important thing in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And I can absolutely see how that plays out.
I think as well, though, this is a problem. A lot of organizations, they take the idea of intelligence and they think, well, if you're an able person, and people think I'm very able at a lot of things. I don't know why. I think verbally I'm quite intelligent. The way I think is quite intelligent. But if you ask me to just start writing letters, you'd be quite surprised how not intelligent I would look. So I've been given jobs before where I've started an organization and they've been like, okay, we want you to do the books. We want you to do the, you know, all this administration stuff because you surely would be good at that. And I said to them, I can try, but I don't really think I'm the best person for that. And I've always struggled. Actually, in all honesty, I'd say this to anyone listening now who's in a career they don't feel very happy. When you've got your own business, you find that the strengths that you've been wanting to use for a long time, you have free rein to have a go at just going for it. There's nobody holding you back apart from yourself suddenly. And so I've found that I've had to get people in my organization now to say, you know, I'm trying to find the person who isn't like me, who's the implementer, who can literally, can you just do this, this, and this, and this in a day? And and I've had a bit of an issue whereby I haven't given people a straightforward set of jobs. I've had a bit of everything going on and they've actually wanted it to be more like, can I just know what 5 or 6 tasks I need to do in a day? Because I'm like,
an implementer.
Yeah, because I'm like, we've got all this and we could do that. What do you think about this? And they're like, do you want me to do all this? And I'm like, no, I'm just chatting it. I'm just throwing it out there as a, in the future, we could do this, couldn't we? And I've realized I have to kind of balance my team with people who can do that for me and equally appreciate they don't necessarily want to be more like in the game changer seat because they just want to know how to implement something.
So look at the vocabulary I've just given you. So you kind of intuitively know this stuff. But the what's awesome about this is it's real. It's based on real businesses and trying to make real change happen. So, it doesn't mean that all of the other things aren't valid or aren't relevant or important, you know, knowing that you're a green person or a blue person or in insights or, you know, I remember the moment when I did MBTI and I understood the whole introvert extrovert thing. And I realized that I was managing a team where 90% of them were introverts. I'm this crazy extrovert. And I was frightening the hell out of them because I was like, going, come on, everybody, I'll explain it. And you'll all be excited. I've had
exactly the same experience. My superior. You know,
so I'm not saying they're not important. They're really valuable. But this is a layer. This is the final layer. It's the real one that talks more in terms of, outcome. And what you physically do on a day-to-day basis, not just
my superior told me in the Jesuits that I had to count to 10 in my head if we're in like a group discussion because I would always jump in first. And he said, doesn't mean other people don't have as many ideas or whatever, but just hold back a count to 10 to let somebody have the opportunity to speak because they might be an introvert and it's not as easy for them. And I was like, bang, I'm an extrovert. And actually, I did come up. We could talk about Myers-Briggs too, if you like. I find that fascinating. And I've put together a test I used to do in the classroom for kids to try and help them understand themselves. And when I did that over a weekend's kind of session with somebody, with other people, I was quite extreme on that as well. I didn't come out. There was very little in the middle for me. I'm kind of massive. Well, I won't go through the rest of them. See if you can guess maybe what they are based on this. It'd be interesting if that ties together. But I was kind of, quite an out there example of a character. I wasn't mild anything.
No. I imagine you were extrovert, intuitive,
feeling or thinking.
Feeling. Perception or what's the other one at the bottom?
Judging.
Perceptive or judging. Perceiving.
Yes, I am. I'm ENFP. Well done.
There we go. And I am ENFP today, but I was ENTP.
Okay.
And what happened is that about 10 years ago, I left the corporate world the first time and started a franchise business, a childcare business. In that business, I absolutely had to become more feeling. But I'm not extreme on any of the other three. I'm only extreme on the extrovert.
Okay.
And the other three, I'm right in the middle.
Yeah, so you do vary slightly between them.
When
I was a teacher, I actually did the test and I think I was actually much more towards the J because you have to be organized. You have to make lists. You have to, when you've got a class of kids' work, you can't be scatty about marking. You have to be, I mean, I was slightly, but you've got to be on top of those things. It's only fair for other people. So I was much less spontaneous. But now that I've kind of gone out of that, I think I'm way back down the P side of things. But I appreciate, for anyone listening to this, you might be thinking, what is he going on about? We can talk about Myers-Briggs another time, but just aware of the time, we don't have massively long left. So
what I would say is, just because you're a 9 game changer doesn't, that the being an extrovert doesn't, you can have introvert 9s game changers.
Yeah.
So they don't map onto each other like that. So you'll have your personality profile and you'll have your game changer profile. And, you know, there's not going to be an exact symmetry to them. So the rest of it, what it does, you can read it. It talks about maximizing your strength, approach to leadership, creativity and innovation. This is scrolling, engaging and influencing, getting things done. So that basically gives you some ideas. And what is good is thriving, not surviving, and the power of teamwork. So how you work in a team. So what's... it's not just sort of bigging you up and say these are all the great things about being strong in this proclivity. It'll also say, you know, this is where other people might have difficulty with it. So it'll have that sort of element to it too.
Yep.
So I'm going to leave that with you to have a read through and see how that resonates with you further. Because I know we've kind of run out of time. So,
that's amazing. Interesting? You said about the power of teamwork there. I certainly am somebody who sometimes can't really empathize how somebody else hears what I'm saying. So I'm just kind of, like an idea comes into my head. I'm like, right, let's do it. Bang, this would be amazing. And I'm just kind of enthusiastic about the idea. And then when somebody else says something back to me, I'm almost like, are we speaking a different language? Did you just hear what I said? We've got this amazing idea. And they can probably see it from the point of view of, well, how on earth do we implement this? And which are equally very valid points. Or they might be thinking, no, I'm not the right person for this. Somebody else is the right person for this. Or they're hearing a different way to what I'm saying, and they get they don't get excited by the thing that I'm excited by. They get anxious about the thing that I'm excited by because they can see the other side. And I think the teamwork's going to be very helpful for me to realize I'm a little bit unbalanced. So it's not a bad thing for me to probably have, you know, people I can bounce the idea off who have the other side to maybe kind of temper the idea to something that's implementable.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good.
But life's more exciting though, isn't it? When you're more extreme on one of those things, I guess.
Well, we think it is, but other people think it's terrifying.
This is brilliant. So just to let everyone know, Lucy's going to come on the show and tell us all about her story as well. This is a special thing that I thought I'd like to share with you all. I'm going to get this onto YouTube pretty quick because I think it has a lot of value if you want to actually see the video where you can see all this stuff. However, Lucy, what's the best way, if somebody would like to find out more about this, how is the best way to get in contact with you, to connect with you, so that you could have this conversation with them as well?
Probably LinkedIn, actually.
LinkedIn, so, okay.
Lucy Brown 62 is my handle on LinkedIn. I think, on this sort of professional side. I've also got a Facebook group which focuses on resilience and well-being, so both the nutrition side and this side, and that's called Resilience and Well-being. There's a couple of them. You'll have to look and see which one's mine. I can't tell you exactly without looking now. So those are probably the two best ways of getting me. I also have a website, so lucybrownconsulting.com. So any of those really will get you to me.
And the great thing about Lucy is she understands this kind of psychology of how we tick, but at the same time, she also is following a low-carb way of eating. She can see the gut health, the dietary health of eating low-carb and how that helps our bodies, but at the same time, understanding holistically the whole of us, so which I think is really exciting. So it's tying together the nutrition, the mental health, the perseverance, the persona of each of us and how we work. Is that a fair way of describing?
I think it is. I think Ranjan Chatterjee calls it lifestyle management, and I think that's kind of what it is. Really, it's about managing your whole lifestyle, from how happy you are to how healthy you are, etc.
And I just want to share from my own and sort of experiences as well. At the moment, I'm finding low carb incredibly easy, really easy. I'm a kind of carnivore OMAD, but what's interesting is when I have been in more stressful, not happy situations, two things can happen. I remember I lost lots and lots of weight as a teacher at first because of stress, and I just wasn't eating because I couldn't digest anything. My stomach was just a knot. And at later times, when I was overworking and getting very tired, the craving would come in. I was probably feeling a bit more kind of frustrated, didn't care about food so much and put weight on. So it's interesting how when you feel empowered or maybe content in the place where you are in your life, because I guess your career's in the right place or you feel confident in who you are and you know about yourself, I find that the food for me is much more straightforward as well. And I don't know if that's other people, but I think holistic health is everything. And if this is a way to understand yourself, then obviously that's a good thing.
Great.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lucy, for that. And like I said, you can connect with her on LinkedIn, her website. But yeah, please come back on and we can talk about your story and share that as well. So thank you today for coming on UK Low Carb.
Okay. And thank you very much for having me.